This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
If you've been struggling with your weight, Mochi Health is here to help. Mochi Health is a long-term weight loss solution personalized to fit your unique needs and goals. Meet one-on-one with board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians who are on a mission to listen. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medications at an affordable set price and get them delivered to their home each month. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 at checkout for $40 off your first month of membership.
What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Over the next 2 months, Diane Houston and I are going to explore Irish heritage in Kansas City. We're going to find out how Kansas City became one of the hotbeds for the Irish to emigrate to in the United States, and how the St. Patrick's Day Parade became one of the largest in the United States today. We're going to chat over the next 2 months with Kyle Kelly, the grandson of Kelly's founder, and Pat O'Neill, the Irish historian of Kansas City. Here's part one of our look about how the Irish made Kansas City the place it is today. Well, the Irish connection, obviously, in Kansas City is huge, and we have two of the foremost authorities on the Irish culture, and of course, Kelly's with us in our brand new podcast studio that we've created here at Odyssey. Kyle Kelly and Pat O'Neill are with us, and Diane, I'm going to throw it over to you because you've done more studying on the Irish history in Kansas City, maybe not more so than Pat O'Neill and Kyle Kelly, but I would
sure.
say you're the third most, aforementioned, expert on the Irish culture here in Kansas City, and it's one of the best in the country, really, when you think about it.
We've talked about this before, and Pat has a great book, From the Bottom Up, that has been a source for me. When you're looking for a story, boy, there are plenty of stories in there that can inspire you to look into stuff further. And being myself Irish and being one of the many people in Kansas City who can call themselves part Irish and get real Irish in March, it's a real pleasure to have you guys both here to talk a little bit about the ongoing legacy of Kelly's Westport Inn, and then obviously the Irish in Kansas City. So thanks for being here.
No problem.
Well, thank you.
You know what my dad always said is about historians. He goes, first liar doesn't have a chance. I'm the first one, so you guys can take it from there.
I want to start with the Irish history in Kansas City, and then right. kind of morph into sure. Kelly's and all of that. Yeah. Why is Kansas City such a big place for Irish heritage and a lot of people moving here from Ireland back in the day?
Right. Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
And people ask it all the time. I mean, but what it came down as simple as this: in the 1840s, 1850s, when it was during the famine period in Ireland, where so many immigrants were coming to the United States and settling on the East Coast, and there was like tenements, and they were taken advantage of, and there was it was crowded, it was dirty and nasty, and the Irish-born priest in Kansas City put out a call, and through the newspapers, the Irish newspapers back on the East Coast, and said, "Come to Kansas City, we'll have a job, you'll be centered around a church, a community," and they came by the hundreds. And then they proceeded to do what the Irish do best, and they procreated, and next thing you know, we got 10% of the local population is Irish born.
Yes, so much for those French Catholics. It's like, move over.
Oh, yeah. They don't have time for them.
Kyle, I read something about your grandfather that, to kind of touch on Pat's point a little bit, was he was walking the streets of New York City, saw the tenements, and all these people come running out of the tenements that was on fire, and he's like, screw this, man. There's too many people here. I'm moving west. He goes to L.A., but how did he end up in Kansas City?
Well, that was my dad, not my grandfather.
Your dad, okay.
Yeah. Dad served in the Army during World War II, and he was moved to Kansas City to train in a mechanic school, and this was in like 41 or 42. And during that time, he was introduced to my mother by a family that Pat grew up with, the Berry family from St. Francis Xavier. They introduced my mom and dad, and they got married here in 1943.
Now, there's a caveat to that. You know, he was came here to learn the mechanics, right?
Yeah.
He was already an expert with the church key, and he said that's the only thing he really had any skill.
Right. Which is a great story, because I'm the same way. The best tool that I could use is the church key. Yeah. Anything else, forget about it. So they made him a mechanic because he knew everything about tools. Huh?
That's right. Yeah, he knew which end of the church key to grab.
Yeah.
So
he gets here to Kansas City and then becomes like one of the most important people in Kansas City because he opens a bar where everybody's going. You know, everybody's drinking at the bar and everybody's kind of hanging out. How did all of that kind of come about to establish what we know today as Kelly's Westport Inn?
Well, before that, my mom was pregnant with my oldest sibling, my sister Mary. And they were living in San Francisco. And my mom grew up at 63rd Mission. And she said, we're not staying out here. I'm not going to have a baby where I don't know anybody. So they came back to Kansas City. And a month after my sister was born, Dad started working at the Westport Inn that at the time was owned by three former Kansas City, Missouri police detectives.
Vice squad cops.
Perfect for owning a bar.
Cash only.
Gent, Zahner, and Brock. And that was in February of 47. October of 47, my dad and Art Brock bought out Gent and Zahner. So Dad and Art Brock were the partners, 50-50 business partners in Kelly's or Westport Inn until Art died in 1977.
And I might add, when your dad took over as a bar or bartending there, starting in 1947, right? That was when a lot of more immigrants were coming to the United States after, because, you know, Ireland had remained neutral during World War II, and they paid the price with, you know, sanctions on them and after the war. So a lot more Irish came to the United States in the very days that your dad was starting to bartend at Kelly's.
Yeah.
And is that, it's also interesting, too, because when we think, or when I think of my family and a lot of the influx of the Irish in Kansas City, I think of the 1880s, 1890s.
Right.
That was really the push. That's when, you know, my family ended up in Kansas City after being in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a lot of jobs available. And then there's the safety of the Catholic community, or Irish Catholic community. What's interesting to me is that your dad, Randall, that he was a late bloomer, late coming here, really. I mean, as compared to other people. And there's a really interesting story attached to why he left County Clare, I believe it is, right?
Yes.
So what was the story behind that? I think he was born in 1905. So he's a young kid in Ireland, and he decides to move to the United States. What spawned that?
You know, I kind of scratched my head because here's an Irishman moving to a country that's in prohibition. And I thought, what the hell was he thinking?
Dad read the papers.
Right.
Yeah. So Dad was the youngest of four children. And as things were in Ireland then, any family property would be passed down to the oldest boy, the oldest male. And Dad was third in line. So at age 20, he said, let's go. So he and a friend came over, and his friend was the one that saw how many people there were in New York City and said, Kelly, there's way too many people here for me. Mm-hmm. I've seen more people here than all of Ireland in this one city. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he moved back within, I think, months, but Dad weathered.
Kyle doesn't like to talk about it often, but I think it makes the roots of this bar being one of the most authentic Irish pubs in the United States real. And that is that Randall, as a young man, had run-ins with British soldiers, and you know he was raised during the Irish Revolution, the Irish Civil War, and he had a nose that was about 4 inches wide, and that's from getting his nose busted with the end of a gun by an English
black
soldier,
and
black and tan. So that was one of the reasons too that he came west.
I want more on the black and tans, because I was reading the article about your father and grandfather, and I saw the black and tans. I'm like, oh, I love a good black and tan. You know, you get the Guinness and the Harp, and you mix them together. But that was like a term for something I never knew about before, something that was in the war, right? The black and tans?
Yeah. It was the occupational forces from Great Britain that were in Ireland And I think the black and tans was the uniform color, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And they kind of like almost like a special forces kind of thing. And when they came to the door of the Kelly farmhouse looking for Randall's older brother, and he was probably, what, 14 or something when he got his nose busted up.
14 to 16 the first time.
By denying that his brother was there.
Wow.
And so, you know, there was a lot of people came with a lot of edge. And that's one of the reasons, in fact, why the Ireland remained neutral in both World War One and World War Two, because they couldn't decide who they hated more, the British or the Germans. And seriously, and that and so so again, there was that big influx. What was interesting about the two, the three vice squad cops that bought the bar, when the original owner was a guy named Taggart. Yeah, Phil Taggart, and he was a wrestler. Right. And a wrestling coach, a wrestling referee at Municipal Auditorium for a lot of the bouts. And he was also a big baseball umpire. But he opened this bar, called it the Wrestler's Inn. And sure enough, he was in a refereeing about it at Municipal Auditorium in 1933, I believe, or four. And one of the wrestlers went to kick the other wrestler and missed and hit Taggart, the referee, and he died. Mm. And so the bar became available, and these three vice squad police, former policemen, they bought the bar. It might have been a good time for them to exit because the police chief was under indictment. And but anyway, it was an ironic thing is, and one of the many connections Kyle and I have is that Art Brock, who was the one that stayed, the one that kind of headed up the three guys that owned it, the Wrestler's Inn, or bought the Wrestler's Inn, was actually turned out to be my widowed grandmother's boyfriend for many years when we were kids. We just knew he had cash.
Pat's still making claims to ownership in Kelly's.
Right, as so he should, right?
We pay him off one boulevard at a time.
Right.
I hope I live a long time.
What an interesting, I think it's interesting, the Wrestler's Inn, because what I read, and it's all you guys, not anything I pulled.
Every bit.
I'm sure you double, triple checked.
Oh, yeah.
And when the Wrestler's Inn opened, I believe it was in 1933 or around there.
Yeah.
When it opened, they would have weekly wrestling matches inside the bar. Mm-hmm. And I just, of course, and I picture Kelly's today, and I'm, you know, where was it?
Yeah,
and where's the level floor?
Well, where's the width of the place that you could even put a wrestling ring in?
I have questions.
So if you, in the front room, there's two ramps that lead up, and then you go into an archway. Well, the next room you walk into is where the matches took place. Mm-hmm. And before we added our deck in 2010, it had a little more surface area. And you can imagine a wrestling match in there, you know, an actual ring, I assume.
Yeah, they say that archway, which has light bulbs in it, was kind of like the stage lights.
Oh, my gosh.
Of its day, because that was the back of the bar then, toward the back of the bar.
Yeah.
Because before the very back rooms were added, those were separate storefronts at one time.
Yeah, because I believe the original building, were, you know, when it was a grocery store prior to, and it was a grocery store and mercantile pretty much in the history of, in the oldest building in Kansas City, but when it was the grocery store in the very back, which I find interesting too, because, you know, who didn't get like Joe's Pizza or Guy's Deli today?
Yeah, right.
In the very, very back, before that really was connected, I believe, because that was a separate building built on. If you look, you can tell it's been segmented out, was a chicken coop, because they would sell chickens, like fresh chickens, like they went and choked their own chickens, not to steal Stroud's, you know, fame here or anything
right,
like that.
Sure.
So then I'm like thinking about the history of that, and, you know, now I've got wrestling matches. It kind of matches the history of Kelly's in a way.
Well, I want to know why nothing like that exists today. Like, why isn't there a place where I can go get a chicken and see a wrestling match? Like I feel like there's a market for that, guys.
Chicken and pickle does a modern
Yeah, a little bit modern
it's too
version
nice.
Of that, right?
It's
but yeah,
too nice.
It's very nice. Like, I want to go to a place
Exactly.
Where there's a chicken coop, and then next door you're going to see two guys go at it in wrestling. Like we need to get back to that, because we seemingly all lived well back then, right? Nobody had a complaint in the world.
That's
you know,
right.
Go get a chicken and watch two people beat each other up.
And fried chicken was good for you.
That's right. Back then it was. Exactly.
Yeah. My grandmother said.
Yeah. Eat the fried chicken. But like today, like you would never get away with, like, you're opening a place. Yeah, we're going to sell chickens here. We're going to have a wrestling match on a Friday night, and the rest of the time we're going to serve scotch. Like that just doesn't exist in America anymore.
Well, you know, we'll go back to the name of the book, and Kyle, and when we first started sitting down to talk about this, you know, it had to be The Poor Man's Playground. And explain why.
You know, I think Dad was asked in the 60s or something about the atmosphere at Kelly's, et cetera. And he said, oh, this is, it, he called it the poor man's playground as opposed to a country club. If you can't afford a country club, you can afford a dime beer, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's, that was the kind of our take on the whole thing about running the place.
Yeah.
It's well, everybody's, that everybody's
legacy,
welcome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That legacy lives on. I mean, yeah, because the customers today and yesterday and tomorrow are so diverse. I mean, in the past, it's been movie stars. It's been, you know, drunk painters. It's been truck drivers. It's been everybody, you know, black, white, every, you know, different colors, different people from different societies. Thomas Hart Benton might be drinking next to the president of a bank, the Southside Bank. You know, you just, yeah, it's, and that, that carries on, and that's still that way. And what's the charm of it is, if you've ever been like McSorley's in New York or whatever, mm-hmm, you know, their decor was not fashioned by any designer. It was just like whatever happened, happened, yeah, and that's what's on the walls. And that's what, you know, it was an organic sort of decor, you know, that today it's real. You know, it's not, there's no plastic plants and there's no, you know, there's no formica.
No ferns.
Hey, but there's something to be said for that, though.
For
I mean, yeah, you know, you start to look at, you know, like we were in Europe in this past year over in England. You walk into these pubs, nothing matches. You're like, who designed any of this? And to hear that kind of story, like, you didn't have to design it, is a great thing, because it just feels more natural that way. It mm-hmm feels more welcoming, I would yeah think, that way than having all the same tables and chairs and all that kind of stuff. You just go in and you know you're at a place where you're going to feel welcome.
Yeah,
and if you get a chair that's not crooked, then you're probably in the wrong place.
Right,
or you're too sober.
You brought it yourself.
You did, you did. So the Irish coming here to Kansas City. I've heard a story from my friends over at Brown's Irish Market. One of the big reasons why Kansas City became this attractive area is because it reminded people of Ireland, the kind of the rolling hills and the greenery and all that kind of stuff. How much of what Kansas City had to offer from an aesthetic standpoint was a big reason too why a lot of the Irish came here?
Well, that's true, and they contributed to the aesthetic. You know, the stonework you see all around the city later was Italian, but originally it was all quarried by Irishmen, and who had, you know, I mean, if you've been on the island of Ireland, it's grass, dirt, and rock. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's and lots yeah and lots of rock, and so everything was built out of rock because it was the cheapest material, right? Mm-hmm. And so they knew how to fabricate rock, stone, and whether it's the old churches down in the west side or it's the walls around Liberty Memorial, or even the Union Station, a lot of that was crafted by Irish stonemasons.
I think, too, there was a really good, Kansas City was in segregated areas, but there was a good amount of people early on like we said, in the 1850s, brought by Father Donnelly. And when Father Donnelly had called for the Irish immigrants, mm-hmm, I still can't believe he asked them to be sober. I'm still confused by that. And it worked, but to have the Irish immigrants come here and then also already have an established Catholic community. And mm-hmm then for them, and you can really see it. And I never really thought about it. I mean, I went to Catholic grade school, went to St. Thomas More, which was like, it's like Kansas City South. That was the large parish, but it used to be, you know, my parents, you know, went to St. Francis and they went to St. Peter's and like just sitting here now, we have connections, which is pretty amazing. Because Kansas City is so connected in a big, small town, we have connections that are within, you know, two people. You can get the connections of different people because everybody kind of stays in that same Catholic community. I mean, true. They really do.
I took my three-year-old yesterday down. We drove downtown, then caught the streetcar. I get on the streetcar, and it's Kevin Sheehy driving the streetcar. And he brings him to get up. He's honking the horn and ringing the bell. I go, yeah, two degrees of separation or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's so strong in Kansas City. And that's what I find. Like you were talking about, you know, how I think it was that your father met his wife and that same, the Barry family. I know the Barry family. But like one of them was my electrician for a while. Yes. it is so, I think that what makes Kansas City so special and unique to other areas is that we, you know, of course, we have a high Irish population in Kansas City that still, you know, identify, if you ask, which are ancestry, Irish. We have that high Irish population, but we've also kind of melded in with other different communities, which is really cool, like yeah Germans and, yeah, you know, all of that.
Even back in the day when the St. Pat's Parade started right up in the 1870s. it was very ecumenical. I mean, there'd be, of course, you know, again, my dad always said the first liar didn't have a chance. So the crowd estimates that I see in the old newspapers may or may not be true. But but still, there were thousands of people, and they would gather after the Mass at Old St. Patrick's usually and go from there down to the River Market all the way all around. But there'd be the temperance societies, the German societies, all everybody walked in those early parades. And I just as a kind of a footnote is the parades ended in the 1890s because of sectarian, some violence that occurred on the West Side between, there was a big movement among, called the American Protective Association in the 1890s, and it was just, it was very anti-Catholic, very anti-Irish, because they, you know, the Irish had come in with the railroads and then populated towns like Kansas City and soon moved their way into city government, yep. county government, and all that sort of thing. So they were afraid of this thing called the Pope that was sending these assault
soldiers,
soldiers into the United States to take over everything, government and all that. So there was, and there was a, ended up being a clash between on election day in the 1894, I think it was, where a couple guys were killed, Irish guys were killed, and there was a lot of fighting and violence. And that the basically the city said put the kibosh on the parades, and they didn't resume until 1974.
Yeah, what was it, like 100 years that it went without the parade or like that? Like, like a very long period of time. So your dad decided like he was going to get the parade started again with Mike Murphy, and they marched like the two of them down the
Murphy
street,
and
right?
My dad and Hogarty, they spent minutes planning that parade.
Minutes, yeah. Wow. Probably at Kelly's, right?
No, at Hogarty's Saloon downtown. Yeah. And they, you know, had it all the logistics figured out and all that. They said, hey, we'll meet on the corner up by the Intercontinental Hotel and not the Intercontinental, but the was it later Mark Twain Towers or the Playboy Club was.
Yeah.
They're going to meet on that corner and then walk down to Hogarty's and try to get a crowd to pull into Hogarty's for business. That was the whole
hour.
That was the whole idea. And so on the way down to the parade, they said, "Well, what if nobody shows up?" And my dad said, "Well," had my mom paint a sign in the car that said parade and one that said into parade, and they could hang it on Danny Hogarty, figuring he's big enough to be a parade all by himself if nobody showed up. That's a true story.
So how did it work? Did it drive business? Did it do what they want? Was it like the spawning of a great idea that they just took off from there?
Or? Oh, yeah, yeah. And they forgot things like permits and things to do that.
Sure.
Right? But they only went, they always claim they went a block and a fifth into Hogarty's. So. on purpose. And that really our irony is, and that we're coming up on a anniversary, a big anniversary for the parade, but because that year St. Patrick's Day was on a Sunday, and they weren't open on Sunday, and nobody came down on Saturday, so they had the parade on Friday, which was 2 days before St. Patrick's Day. You could see Hogarty and him walking in front of buses. I mean, there are buses waiting behind him because they just walked in, gathered everybody, walked down the street, and there was probably 30 or 40 people. And today, you know, there's about 300,000 people that say they were there that day.
Yeah, downtown Kansas City wasn't exactly what it is today either.
No,
so
poor Bill.
Draw them out.
Poor Bill Cahill, who was one of your dad's friends.
Yeah,
the policeman. He was kind of assigned to the whole thing. I think he was the only one there. All I remember is I think it was the second year. Is he had one of those little Cushman carts? You know, those little. A police, you know, like a
right.
almost like a golf cart with a cover on top, and he parked it out in front of Hogarty's. He was trying to direct traffic up the street, and there was like 12 guys building a beer pyramid over the top of his Cushman cart while he was up directing traffic. I have a picture of it somewhere. I guess.
So the parade obviously is one of the biggest now in the nation. Was that kind of their goal? Their thinking of going in to get it like that? Or were they just, hey, man, let's just walk to Hogarty's for one day and see what happens?
Hogarty's would only hold about 40 people. They were hoping to get that many in the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did they get it to be so big, though? How did they grow that thing so fast?
Murphy was a great promoter, and he was at the the peak of his career. I mean, he was he had record. I mean, radio numbers. You guys know how they measure radio audiences, but his was like 24 or something. It was on a huge percentage of the market that you'd never get today. Nobody can get that kind of thing today. So, yeah, he just had fun with it, and of course, then realized that he had promised to have a parade next year. So I guess he better have one.
As you can see, the St. Patrick's Day parade was an afterthought at first, but turned into one of the largest parades in the United States today. Come back next month. We'll explore the history of Kelly's, the oldest building in Kansas City, Missouri, with Kyle Kelly and Pat O'Neill.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom?
Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Nerds!
Today's episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. Smart Travel doesn't just cover points and miles. They break down all the financial aspects of your trip, whether that's the best days to book, how to avoid hidden fees, or which fancy travel credit cards pay off, and which ones are just an expensive flex. If you want your travel budget to work harder, then dive into the best deals, products, services, and more with Smart Travel from NerdWallet, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omicid, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism, so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omicid.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Knicks Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Knicks, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Knicks Menswear, your friend in style.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. 5 times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.